On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
He was over 6 feet tall, sometimes 350 pounds. In his prime, he could hit a high C with a radiant joy that brought opera fans to tears. When Luciano Pavarotti died yesterday of pancreatic cancer at 71, the larger-than-life Italian superstar had brought more opera to more people than any singer in history. Up next, On Point, remembering Pavarotti. Joining me now from Washington is Tim Page, Pulitzer Prize-winning music critic for The Washington Post. He was named as one of the most influential people in the world of opera by Opera News. From 1999 to 2001, he was the artistic advisor and creative chair for the St. Louis Symphony Orchestra. He wrote today's front-page obituary on Pavarotti for The Washington Post. Tim, thanks for being with us today.
It's good to be here. Thanks for having me.
And with us from New York, Anne Midgett, a classical music reviewer for The New York Times. She first interviewed Pavarotti in 1998. And went on to co-author in 2004 The King and I, a tell-all book about Pavarotti, written with his longtime manager, Herbert Breslin. And thank you very much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Tim, give us the headline here. How do you describe the man who is now gone?
Well, he was almost certainly the biggest star in the history of opera, certainly the biggest serious star. He really reached an amazingly wide audience, and not only the opera connoisseur who really just admired the spectacularly sweet tone and the just the sheer beauty of the voice, but also he reached across to people all across the spectrum. He made popular recordings. He made American Express ads. He appeared on The Tonight Show. He joined in, I can't forget this, in the Three Tenors, which became the best-selling classical record of all time, if it can actually be called a classical record, which I guess it sort of can. He was an amazing musician, certainly an amazing singer, and at his best, a very, very great musician indeed.
Let's get his speaking voice in here with us for just a second. NPR's Susan Stamberg interviewed Pavarotti in 1999. She found out that Pavarotti thought of his voice almost as a mistress, a she, not quite his master's voice, is it?
What about your voice, Mr. Pavarotti? How do you take care of it?
Well, I let her do what she wants. No, that is not true. I try to keep her away from cold weather and heavy food, spicy foods. Well, the voice doesn't need much more than take very good care to the body.
I love how you call your voice her.
Her. She's a person. She's the lady who make me slave. She put me under her dominion.
She's a lady who makes me a slave. Anne Midgett, what about the personality of this man off the stage? We hear some of it right there.
Well, I think his personality was very tied up with his public persona and his private persona were very linked. He had a kind of legendary charm, particularly with interviewers. And he really thrived off of interaction with his public and his fans. And he had a real knack for that. And that's part of the reason he was able to attain such stardom. He really reached people on a very personal level in some way. And I think he ended up giving most of his life to developing that persona through whatever means it took. It's interesting to note that opera was originally a populist art form, and he tapped into that tradition. Enrico Caruso was also a populist, one should remember. Pavarotti was not the first to reach a mass audience, but he was the first in a long time to do so, and perhaps the one who has succeeded most in our memory.
Caruso, also a populist, Tim Page, but here's Pavarotti in the media age, and in some ways he was an original, he was a great, he was also, was he not, a kind of media creation?
Yes, to some extent, but you couldn't just create a Pavarotti out of nothing. I mean, it really was an extraordinary voice. It really was an extraordinary artistry when he was working hard, which was not always the case. And we have to remember that Pavarotti could reach more people in one single night, in one single appearance on a television program than Caruso reached in his whole career. I agree with Anne that Caruso was a populist. I've never really thought that Pavarotti was so much Caruso's heir, except on the side of public relations. It's always seemed to me that Domingo is much more a Caruso-like tenor, at least the later Caruso. Pavarotti, with the modern media, managed to reach just a spectacular audience, just an unprecedented audience. In one evening, more people probably heard him than all the tenors who sang in the 19th century.
At the height of his popularity, you write today, he may have received 50,000 fan letters a year. Some of his performances may be seen by a billion people, and some portion of them calling in right now. And I want to bring Pavarotti fans right into the middle of this conversation, Tim and Ann, if I may. Let's begin to take calls. David is calling from Hopkinton, Massachusetts. David, you're on the air.
Hi. Thanks very much for taking the call. It's hard to articulate, but I was listening to the radio this morning, and they were playing, you know, just a couple of the snippets of some of the arias, maybe 5-6 seconds long.
Yes.
And I'm not specifically an opera fan in the sense that I don't even know, and I've never really known what operas those are from. I'm a singer in a rock and roll band. But
okay.
After I heard it, there was a quote that came to mind by Pete Townsend from a song called Pure and Easy about the power of a single note. And Pavarotti was one of those people who, as a human being, could produce, you know, a single tone, a single tonality of such amazing power and grace that you don't have to understand the language. You don't even have to hear much of what's coming before then. But when that note strikes you, it's like, it's in the Pete Townsend's words, it's, there once was a note, pure and easy, playing so free as a breath rippling by. The note is eternal, it hears me, I hear it, it sees me, forever we're blended, forever we die. And as a singer, I've always looked in my own part to achieve that single note that for me would be like, sort of like the true voice of God coming through a human being. And I've never seen Pavarotti, I've never really paid a lot of attention to opera, but when I hear those notes, it literally brings me to tears. So this morning I'm driving to work and I'm sitting there and bang, with no, you know, the other prompting, it's just that powerful. And I think there's just so few people in history and in the world that can achieve that level of experience from just their body, no involvement with man-made instruments or recording or anything. To me, that's just incredibly powerful.
David, that's great. The rock and roll singer doffs the hat to the opera great here, and thank you very much for that. Tim, you wrote this morning right on that subject about Pavarotti, famous for hitting the high C's, and you quote him saying that when he's singing those great high notes that he feels like a kind of show jumper or competitor. He said, stretched to my limits, excited and happy, but with a strong undercurrent of fear, the moment I actually hit the note, I almost lose consciousness. A physical, animal sensation seizes me. Then, after it has been successfully negotiated, I regain control. Wow. There he was, king of the high C.
Well, I never heard him actually talk quite so poetically, but it's a good quote.
You write that he was almost tricked into hitting that high C that he was famous for
that,
the first time.
That's certainly the story that Richard Bonning was playing and just sort of transposed things up or somehow got him. Anne may remember this story better than I do.
I believe actually that was Sutherland that Bonning tricked up the scale, because Pavarotti worked with an Italian teacher who got him up there. I think it was Arrigo Pola who got him up there pretty comfortably. Pavarotti didn't have much trouble at the beginning of his career, certainly with those free high notes.
Joan Sutherland was his co-star in his first big appearance in the U.S. in Miami.
In Miami, exactly. And he was a substitute for Renato Cioni, who was called off to Italy at the last minute to the great disappointment of all the people who had bought tickets to hear him, rather ironically today, since those people got to hear Luciano Pavarotti's debut in America instead.
Yeah, oh, tut, poor them. Joan Sutherland, Tim, became a big promoter of this young, big guy from Italy.
Yeah, she certainly was. And she was very much a soprano and indeed a figure that you wanted on your side starting off a career. I mean, it's hard for people, I think, to remember now how much more opera was, how incredibly important Sutherland was in the 60s and 70s, and really on towards even the end of her career. An amazing person, and she was a good ally.
We're talking this hour about the man and the music, Luciano Pavarotti, the great opera singer, dead yesterday at his home in Modena, Italy at 71 of pancreatic cancer. Tim Page joins us. He's the Pulitzer Prize-winning music critic for The Washington Post. And Anne Majette, classical music critic for The New York Times. She first interviewed Luciano Pavarotti in 1998. Let's hear him once more. It was long rumored that Pavarotti could not read music. A BBC interviewer put the question to him directly.
Can you settle something for me? I have read that you barely read music. Is that true?
Depends what you mean. You can say that I barely read the score for the orchestra. That, yes. But this, the partitura that you go to buy for the tenor piano, no. That I read perfectly.
Okay. So maybe some limits there, but he could read what he needed to read. Anne Majette, you know, there was a kind of a rough-hewn quality about him in a way, even as he was at the very top. Tim Page reports that at some concert or two, he was found to be lip-syncing when it was all over, and there was this laziness charge that
It was only one concert that he lip-synced, because we got in trouble about that in our book, because some people read it as if he had lip-synced more than once.
Just one, 1992 once. In Italy.
Yes.
But still kind of hard to believe for a famous opera singer, lip-syncing?
Well, it was in a concert, one of his pop concerts that he did in Modena, and there was a tremendous flap about it, which evidently still resonates. But it was mortifying to him that he was caught, and he did apologize. But I don't think, in fairness, that it was an opera piece or even a piece in his Fach, that is his normal repertory.
He actually, as I recall, he gave some kind of quote at the time, because I covered it for Newsday, and it was something along the lines of, well, I have to save my voice.
Yeah, well, that saves it all right. And Milli Vanilli saved their voices, too.
Yeah.
Well, he liked to save his voice during performances at the end, too. I saw a performance of Tosca where he sang perhaps a quarter of the notes. It was clear that he was sparing himself for the big notes and felt that the in-between notes were not, at that point, as important.
Now, was that later on in his career, when maybe there wasn't as much stamina in that voice as there had been?
Absolutely not. That was at the very, very end of his career, when Tosca was about the only opera he would agree to sing because it was easier. Which is not a slam on him. He was getting on by that point. But if you look at the opera performances he gave toward the end of his life, it became more and more about Tosca.
Mm. Tim, on the rascal front, you remind us, he was also criticized sometimes for his frequent cancellations. Lyric Opera of Chicago in 89, pretty early on, refused to hire him anymore after he canceled 26 of 41 scheduled performances over 8 years.
Well, you've got to realize that if you're selling somebody like Pavarotti and you get all these people who are paying lots and lots of money to come hear Pavarotti, and he's suddenly replaced by, let's go back to the beginning, by Renato Cioni or something, they're going to be a little bit unhappy. And it finally got to a point in Chicago where the woman who was then involved made a very, very public, Artis Krainic, the late director, she made a very public kind of firing, saying, we will not hire Pavarotti anymore. And he said, well, maybe the air is no good for me in Chicago. And it was one of those ridiculous and hilarious opera dust-ups.
too moist off the Great Lakes there.
Yeah.
Tim, Anne, if you'd stand by for just a moment, I want to welcome in another voice from New York. Martin Bernheimer joins us, critic for the Financial Times and Opera Magazine, a kind of elder statesman in the opera-watching world. Was music critic at the L.A. Times for 31 years, won the Pulitzer Prize for his music criticism, and covered Pavarotti's entire American career, beginning way back in 1967. Martin Bernheimer, thank you very much for being with us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Just as a musical matter, as an operatic matter, apart from his popularity and his, you know, joyous, joie de vivre kind of personality, how do you characterize Pavarotti's voice, his vocalization, the singer?
Well, basically, I think, I think there were two Pavarottis. The early Pavarotti, who was blessed with a glorious instrument and considerable musicality and enormous charm and a serious attitude toward his art. And the later Pavarotti, who became something of a self-caricature. I hate to speak ill of the dead, but I guess I get paid for that. Who coasted on his enormous self-image, who gave stadium concerts using microphones, who gave concerts in concert halls where no microphones were needed, but still used them, who transposed, who sang with the music in front of him, even though it seemed unlikely that he really needed it, who made a ghastly Hollywood film called Yes, Giorgio.
Oh, yeah.
Who gave performances in which he barely bothered to move, much less act, and everyone had to come to him. So he became, I think, an unfortunate reflection of what he could have been. And it's hard for me to look back at the good Pavarotti without seeing the other one as well.
Well, take us to the good piece of that, or the better piece in your opera listeners' views. When he was young, when he wasn't, you know, maybe slacking or playing to the stadium, what would you say about his voice, his style?
It was a natural instrument of extraordinary beauty, equality of range from top to bottom, a top extension that was unbelievable for a voice of its size. He was sort of a spinto, not quite the light lyric tenor of someone like Di Stefano in his youth, and certainly not a heroic tenor who could sing Otello, much less Wagner. But in that middle area, he was virtually without peer. And I think the one memory that I have of him that I will never discard is the early performances of La Fille du Régiment, where he sang the famous aria with the nine high Cs. And he not only made it sound beautiful, he made it sound easy. Many tenors have done it since then, but not that many before. So this was around 1972. And for that alone, he's worth putting in anyone's memory book.
And Majette, when you spoke with Pavarotti, did he characterize his own voice, his own style and operatic presence to you? How did he see it?
He said to me, with a certain amount of pride, that his voice was unmistakable, and that when you turned on the radio and heard it, you do not mistake me for another voice, which I think is absolutely true. I think that Pavarotti was maybe not as invested in the artistry of the whole thing from the beginning. He was a fine artist when he wanted to be, but remember that the Yes, Giorgio movie was made in 1979 or 1980, fairly early on.
Yeah.
And I completely concur with what Martin said about the two Pavarottis, but I think they were there from the very beginning, that for him it was really about communicating with an audience, and he had this kind of natural gift and ability to do it. But how he did it didn't matter quite so much to him as it did to some of us, particularly us critics who were very invested in the art and the higher end of the entertainment spectrum.
But if you look at those early reviews or those early performances, he got good reviews.
He got excellent reviews until he began pushing himself into territory where he didn't really belong, like the heavier Verdi things.
His Met debut, his San Francisco debut, it was definitely positive.
Oh, yes.
No one sat back and said, oh, my God, a superstar has arrived. It's evolved, you know.
Yeah, Tim Page, before what you call the Huggy Bear Pavarotti, you know, before the highest paid, best-known classical artist maybe in history, remind us of the story of where he came from. His father was a baker, who also a tenor who sang on the side. His mother worked in a cigarette factory. Growing up in the same town where he died, how did he come from that beginning to Pavarotti?
Well, I don't know. There's something about the Italian son, I sometimes think. He worked hard. The voice is recognized very early as a very beautiful one. Martin is correct, and Anna, they're both correct on the fact that the reviews were very, very good. But part of that, I think, is just people holding back a bit. You know, it's a little bit tough to go out there and say, you know, especially after a first appearance, that this is going to be the guy who's going to be the great tenor of the, you know, late part of the 20th century, or certainly one of the great tenors. And one other thing which I would mention here, too, is that I think that the, if you want, good and the bad Pavarotti really coexisted for a long time. I mean, the same summer he was making Yes, Giorgio, he was making what I'd have to say is maybe my very favorite Pavarotti recording, which is that spectacular William Tell, a complete recording of a Rossini opera with not only high Cs, but high C sharps, and lots of them.
And so it was, and I remember even in the 90s when he'd already become, you know, Mr. Stadium and Mr. Three Tenors, he gave a very, very chaste and beautiful and altogether terrific recital of Italian songs at Carnegie Hall. So the cheap and the magnificent really existed in him pretty much concurrently all along.
Here's a man who taught elementary school and sold insurance while he was very young, vying in opera competitions, you report, before he got in. Then the training began, intensive training on posture, 6 months spent on how to hold his jaw, you write, Tim.
That's what they say.
Wow. Let's go to Lawrence, calling from Methuen, Massachusetts. Lawrence, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom and guests. Because of the state of opera in Boston isn't all that great, it's quite a bit less than what they enjoy in Washington, D.C., San Francisco, and Seattle, I did happen to have a chance to hear Pavarotti three times in New York, two in fully staged operas that are on the fringe of the repertoire, which would be Verdi's Lombardi and Andrea Chenier by Giordano. They were still tough tickets because he was singing, but I did manage to get in. But one of the most memorable concerts was the Richard Tucker Memorial Concert. I pulled out the program this morning, November 11th of 1990. He was known for helping young singers along, and on that program that day were people just starting out in the Metropolitan Opera, their Metropolitan Opera careers, like Denise Graves and Samuel Ramey. And then the Richard Tucker audition winner was Renee Fleming. She was making her first New York appearance. And I almost came away from that telling my friends, well, I heard Pavarotti last weekend, but let me tell you about this soprano.
Right.
And I think that's one aspect of his career. And toward the end, there's a young man named Paul Potts in England who claims that he got some assistance from Pavarotti just last summer. And so that's one aspect of Pavarotti's career, the work he did to help young singers move along.
Lawrence, you sound like part of the Cognoscenti. You're not put off by the I don't know, what we heard NPR say the Italian some saw as the vulgar side of Pavarotti's career. Doesn't sound as though you
are. Well, I thought he was just fine in the fully staged operas I heard. I never saw him put out less than a quality singing performance. In the André Chenier, as one of your guests mentioned, he barely moved. I think they dimmed the lights during a sword fight, and then they put them back up, and then the action is set in the during the French Revolution, and he's a revolutionary, and there had to be some action, but there wasn't much action. But I don't think the audience cared, because if they wanted to see a play about the French Revolution, they'd go to the theater and not worry about it. But they came to hear him sing, and that he did.
Lawrence, that's wonderful. Pavarotti's Action in the Dark. Yes.
I have a memory of the one Andrea Chenier at the Met, where he was supposed to get into a sword fight, and he stood up from the table, and what the Met did was they had some dancers all of a sudden, for no reason at all, get in front of the table where they were supposed to be having the sword fight, and they'd move around. The dancers would sort of twirl around and obscure the vision. And then they'd move off, and there was Pavarotti standing up going, "Aye!" as if he'd just been stabbed. It was absolutely ridiculous.
And he was a big guy, and sometimes enormously big, up to 350. How did his physical size play into his performance, his life?
Well, one of his former secretaries and possible girlfriends assured me that he had a really nice butt.
even at 350, okay.
Even at 350, but I suppose there was a bit of fondness speaking there.
I mean, he ended up marrying one of his secretaries.
He did end up marrying one of his secretaries.
Mantovani.
Yeah, but as far as it affecting his movement on stage, he was always wooden. Even when he was young, he was quite a strapping man when he was young. And there's a story about a director at the Met saying, you know, Luciano, don't do so much. He was making some very crude gesture, saying, just hold still. And Pavarotti said, but if I do that, will they know that I am acting?
Martin, what's your sense of his physical presence?
It was a problem. There was a famous Aida, I think his first Radames is in San Francisco, which was staged in a way that he would make all his entrances upstage center and move toward the footlights and never stand sideways. When he did move, it was...
no profile, please.
I beg your pardon?
No profile, please.
No profile. On the other hand, he, in addition to his size, he did suffer physical infirmities toward the end of his career, which made movement very difficult for him. Even in L'Elysée d'Amore, some of his entrances, he couldn't come in alone. He would be sort of joined by a chorus of ballet girls who would sort of lead him and support him when he made his entrance. And with any other singing actor, that could have been disastrous. But as your caller said, many people came not to see opera, which I regard as musical drama, but to see a personal appearance by a great star. And if you're willing to accept that, he was great. If you think opera means more than beautiful sounds, you might have been frustrated, no matter how beautiful those sounds were.
We're remembering Luciano Pavarotti. Here he is singing Che Gallida Menina from Puccini's La Bohème. La lasci riscaldar, cercare che giova, al buio non si trova. Ma per fortuna una notte di luna, e qui la luna l'abbiamo vicina. Aspetti, signorina, le dirò con due parole. Chi sono? Chi sono? Che faccio? And there he is. Luciano Pavarotti, dead at 71 of pancreatic cancer. Tim Page of the Washington Post is with us, Anne Majette of the New York Times, and Martin Bernheimer, critic for the Financial Times and Opera magazine. You can join the conversation as well. Was this your man, your voice for opera? Did you find him sublime, or like some Italians, a bit too vulgar? Did Pavarotti introduce you to opera, to Puccini and La Bohème, Nessun Dorma, and the great arias? Did his smile make you smile, his joy bring you joy? We're at 800-423-8255. It's 800-423-TALK. Let's take a call from Buffalo, New York. Alice, you're on the air.
Thank you, Tom. I discovered Pavarotti through PBS, and I think he saw more of the people for whom he was singing than he did the critics. I have a touching memory of a Christmas program at the cathedral in Montreal, where a boy choir member stood next to Pavarotti just singing a solo, and Pavarotti just put his arm on a little boy's shoulder, and that said more to me than any of the critics.
One of the maybe billion fans made right there. Alice, thanks very much for that. Tim Page, that takes us to the three tenors. I mean, Christmas albums and all the rest. He would stand up and draw enormous crowds, but that also left him, you know, Domingo and Carreras alongside him with part of this, the populist image that not all the cognoscenti really liked.
Well, the fact of the matter is I'd just rather hear Beatles songs sung by the Beatles or Those Were the Days by Mary Hopkin or, you know, I mean, other people do that material better, or so it seems to me. For me, the three tenors was an exercise in diminishing returns because I thought so highly of Pavarotti and Domingo and Carreras, and I thought that it was like having, you know, three pianos playing. You don't hear the same sensitivity that you do when you just have one of them. The first one was kind of fun. I thought it became kind of a shtick, but you know, if they're making $1 million a night, it's kind of hard to stop, I would think.
Each singer making $1 million a night. The first one in 1990 wasn't the case at the Roman Baths in Italy there, but then they came back and sang together in Los Angeles. You write that as many as 1 billion people heard portions of the second Three Tenors event. And, of course, as Alice in Buffalo was saying, PBS has played it a couple of times since then. And what about the relationship between those three men over time?
Well, Domingo and Pavarotti are always poised as rivals or set up in the press as rivals. And I think there was a certain amount of competition early on. I think the Three Tenors brought them all together in a way in the quest
to make a lot of money out of a thing that was going really well. It's amusing to know that the three tenors partly continued as a phenomenon because for the first show, each of the three artists accepted a one-off payment, mm-hmm. which seemed rather high at the time, but then it became one of the best-selling, not only classical records, but I believe one of the best-selling records of all time. And, of course, the producers made millions and millions, and the three tenors vowed that was never going to happen again. So they made sure there were plenty of other three tenors concerts. But I agree with Tim. The first one was kind of fun, and then it became a bit of a shtick.
Placido Domingo is saying in a statement after his death that early on, the sort of entertainment industry had tried to set them up as rivals, thinking that would be good for each of their careers and maybe good for the business. He said what really happened was that our careers encouraged each other. Eventually, we both fooled everybody by becoming real friends who respected each other for their individual strengths and weaknesses.
You can look back in some early press clippings and see whether it was all the press that was giving nasty quotes about each other to the press very early on. I do believe that later on they were not the rivals they were depicted as early on.
Martin Bernheimer, what about Pavarotti and how he was seen by other professional opera singers?
You'd have to ask them. I really don't know. I mean, certainly some of his female partners adored him or claimed to do so. Mirella Freni, who was his Mimi both at the Met debut and the San Francisco debut, and who gave a very touching statement today. Carol Van Ness, who was his last Tosca at the Met and who did all the work that night, all the heavy lifting, all the moving. In fact, even at the beginning when Tosca is presumably locked out of the chapel because Cavaradossi has had an exchange with an escaped prisoner, and she's supposed to bang on the door until he lets her in, and she says, "Perché chiuso?" Why is the door locked? And in this production, Pavarotti didn't move. No one opened the door. She just came in anyway. But she told me quite a bit afterwards that she would have done anything for him because he'd been so supportive and kind to her throughout her career. So I think he was a good colleague as long as no one stepped on his toes or got in his way and as long as someone put themselves out for him. There's one other thing I'd like to bring up, if
please.
I may.
Yes, please.
This business about this huge, massive international audience that he brought in by the stadium concerts and the three tenors and all that. There's no question that they created a multitude of Pavarotti fans. Mm. But I always wonder, did these Pavarotti fans then become opera fans? I just don't know, and I have some element of doubt.
I think definitely not. I think it created a whole different species of fan, which now feeds Andrea Bocelli, Josh Groban, and Il Divo.
But
I think there's very little evidence that those people are coming in to hear the opera. He created a sort of new genre of music, if you will.
But what about for aspiring opera singers? Do they all want to be Pavarotti now or not? Do they feel unfulfilled if they don't have an audience of 1 billion? Did he move the bar, or was he sort of sui generis, one of a kind, and others are not trying to follow?
Well, I think his legacy has hurt young singers in that every young tenor who comes along with a hint of promise is immediately trumpeted as the next Pavarotti, which is not a great thing to do to a young tenor who needs maybe 10 or 15 more years of work to really see if he has the longevity. But certainly today, as opera increases its range with broadcasting and things, it's following some of the models Pavarotti, if not pioneered, enjoyed exploiting, shall we say.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to East Hampton, New York, and Pete, you're on the air.
Well, thank you very much. I have a very quick question for your guests. I would like them to compare Mr. Pavarotti with another great opera singer beginning in the early 1960s, and that would be Franco Corelli, who also had a great stage presence and electrified audiences.
Franco Corelli, Martin and Tim, who would pick that up?
I'll be happy to. Corelli was a genuine heroic tenor with a fabulous instrument, an equally good top extension, a heavier, darker voice, made little or no attempt to court the masses the way Pavarotti did. But I would say that in his way, he was just as great a tenor, and he lived in an age of great tenors. I mean, there was Richard Tucker, there was Nicolai Gedda. There were many, many other great tenors at that time, more than there are now. So it's easier to look back and wonder, I suppose.
Am I the only person who thinks that Corelli was something of a shouter? I only knew him on record, but I have to say I
you
don't play his records.
You ever heard him sing the B-flat diminuendo at the end of Celeste Aida? He could be a shouter, but he also, under the right circumstances with a good conductor, was a singer of some finesse.
Everyone speaks about the sort of sunshine, exuberance, joy in Pavarotti's voice. How much of that do you give straight to the voice, Martin, and how much to his overall persona?
Since I don't know the persona up close, I can't guess, but I always have the feeling that people on the stage project who they are. And in his case, we did get this charming joie de vivre kind of extrovert, which was very endearing.
Let's go to Jane in Boston. Jane, you're on the air.
Oh, hello. Thank you so much for a wonderful show. This is a great loss. It had been terrible not to be hearing him for the past year, knowing he was ill. But I was one of the millions who was introduced more to opera and got to enjoy it better because of Luciano Pavarotti. I don't think he vulgarized it. He had a wonderful connection to his fans. But I have memories of hearing him with Carol Van Ness in Tosca, and there he was trying to clamber up that ladder, not very successfully, when he couldn't get in the door.
Yeah.
And did anyone see him in Rigoletto when he was the Duke of Mantua and he was nibbling at the nape of Isola Jones' neck? She could barely sing. It was heaven. And please, don't you think the discs will be flying out of the movie stores because everyone will have to see Yes, Giorgio for the wonderful pasta fight? I mean, poor Catherine Harold. He was nibbling at her. He was always nibbling at women. It's one of the best memories.
He likes to eat.
Big appetites.
Hill, he visited, shall we call, some of his fans who lived in my building. So we were graced often with the presence of Luciano. You can't say he swept out of his limo. He rather lumbered out of his limo, blew kisses to the doorman, went up and disappeared to some lovely apartment. It was heaven.
Oh.
It was a wonderful time to live in Manhattan. And there was the kind of not good, I think the last time I heard him live maybe was when Sutherland, when they were in Trovatore with Richard Clarke. And I think it was her last, she got some booze. It was not a happy thing, but he was wonderful.
Oh, you take us right to that heaven, Jane, and we thank you for all that neck nibbling wonder there. Thank you. Let me get another call, if I may, from Lynn, Massachusetts. Donna, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
What
do you know, Donna?
I know another side of Mr. Pavarotti. In 1985, he was at the Worcester Centrum in Massachusetts.
Okay.
And I went with a friend who was always late. So when we got there, Pavarotti was already singing. And it's like the thrill when we got in there of his voice just gave me chills all over me. And it was a concert. It wasn't an opera or anything. And when he started singing Italian folk songs, it was like the place went into an uproar. And it was like it showed the other side of a very famous man who was able to connect to, you know, just these ordinary, everyday people.
And take it right down to the folk songs and drive the crowd crazy.
That's right. Yeah. It was absolutely wonderful. He would definitely be missed.
It's a great memory. Thank you very much, Donna. Of course, the end would come for his singing career a couple of years before, sadly, his death yesterday. Pavarotti was asked in a BBC interview in September 2005, Jeremy Paxton was the interviewer, how an opera singer copes with aging and when he decides it's time to retire.
Well, generally, if the opera singer is around 50 or 60, it's terrible. But at my age, it's beautiful, it's perfect, fantastic. No regrets, and I think important is to sing very well until you sing and have the voice fresh like my father did have. My father was a great tenor, beautiful voice, and he was fresh until 2 weeks before I died at the age of 90.
Some people, of course, say you should have retired some time ago.
Some people probably is right.
Some people are probably right. Yeah. Well, March 2004, his last appearance at the Metropolitan Opera. And Tim, Martin, anyone of you there?
I was there. I was there.
I guess we were all three there.
Oh, great. Yes. Well, tell us about it.
I thought it was pretty awful. It was sad. It was. He had been ill the previous year and had been scheduled to sing Tosca, canceled those amid considerable furor and resentment, especially on the part of the director of the company at the time. And then he made it up the following year. Another tenor graciously stepped aside so he could sing those last two or three performances. And the voice was a shadow of what it had been. As Anne Majette said, he left out portions of the cover of Do-Si-Ro that he didn't feel he needed to sing, saved it for the arias, hardly moved, looked less than romantic, and sounded like a tenor who really should have retired earlier. And I can't help but comparing him to Domingo in that case, because Domingo, who is now somewhere between 65 and 70, depending on whom you believe, has been very careful in singing roles that suit his current vocal estate, leaving out the high roles and flirting with the baritone repertory. And Pavarotti, to the end, even though it was only Tosca, sang the same repertory that he had been singing for 30 years, and therefore invited comparison with himself.
But Anne, for a man with this personality, it must have been hard to stay away from the stage.
I think he had as much of an addiction to the stage and to his audience as he had to food. I think he would have had a terrible time letting go of it. His farewell tour, on which he often simply sat on stage, I believe, and when he wasn't singing, they actually rolled a piano out in front of him and sang, was a sign that he in a way knew it was too late, and yet he still couldn't exist without going on.
I heard the very last of those three Toscas. I did not hear the first two. I was told that he was the best, the last one. So I have a slightly more positive judgment. I agree that he didn't sing everything, and it was obvious that he was moving around in considerable pain. But there were those moments in the arias and a couple other moments where you really still have the sense that this was something pretty special.
Well, we won't judge him on the last, we'll judge him on the whole, and I guess whatever the fine points, you can only call it glorious. I want to thank each of you for being with us today. It's just been wonderful. Martin Bernheimer with the Financial Times and Opera Magazine joining us from New York. Martin, wonderful to have you. Thanks for being here.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Anne Majette with the New York Times, classical music critic there. Thank you very much for joining us, Anne.
Thank you for having me.
And Tim Page, Pulitzer Prize-winning critic for the Washington Post. Tim, thank you for joining us.
Always a pleasure.
Luciano Pavarotti here from Turandot with Nessun Dorma. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.